The path reading this morning is from the chapter Work versus Meditation. The spiritual path would, one suspects, be relatively easy to understand if it involved only meditation, ecstatic visions, and blissful expansions of consciousness. Why, one asks, must it be complicated by mundane activities like ditch digging and letter writing and cleaning up kitchens? One may sympathize, on one level at least, with that reluctant disciple the day we completed the swimming pool at 29 Palms, who grumbled, "I didn't come here to pour cement." Many a sincere devotee, too, has probably wondered what pouring cement or digging ditches or writing letters or cleaning up kitchens has to do with finding God. The answer is, quite simply, nothing. Not in itself, anyway. Master once told the story of a man who placed a $100 bill in the collection plate at church, then was upset because God didn't answer his prayer. Laughingly, Master commented, "God already was that $100 bill, whether in or out of the collection plate. Why should he care where it was placed?" The realm of Maya, cosmic delusion, resembles the surface of an ocean. However high the waves get whipped up by the storm, the overall ocean level remains the same. God doesn't need anything that we can give him. He already is everything. The one thing he wants from us, Master said, is our love. The purpose, then, of spiritual work is not really to do things for God, but rather to do the most important thing of all for ourselves, to purify our own hearts. No work for God is more or less important than any other. The Bhagavad Gita states that he accepts even a flower or a leaf as an offering if it is tendered with devotion. The important thing is to reach the point where all our love, all our energy flows naturally toward him.
This morning my subject is service is joy. And it may seem like a peculiar way to introduce it by talking about a movie that I saw last night, Singing in the Rain. It was great fun. I'd never seen it before. And the dancing was extraordinary. Gene Kelly's excellent. Somebody else whose name I don't know was even better. And never mind. All right, what was it?
Donald O'Connor.
At least he has the right first name. It was great fun, and what I was thinking about as I was observing it was how absolutely involved people can get in whatever it is they're doing. The dancing of Donald O'Connor was just, it couldn't have been any better. But if you want to pull out of it and not let yourself get sucked into the excitement of the moment, naturally you can't help but think, why? Why all this excitement? They get so excited about nothing. And where is its fun? You begin to think, my God, I've been doing this for God knows how long, and where will it all end? There isn't an end to it. There is the thought that if we get sufficiently intensely involved, we'll be so excited that it'll all just somehow work out, sort of like Mardi Gras in Rio, that they get so whipped up that they forget that there's tomorrow and it's exhaustion. They forget that there's always something else afterwards. And I don't mean to put the movie down. It was a wonderful job. What I mean, however, is to help us to remember that the answers to what we're really looking for don't come in the directions that people are offering you when they get all involved in a thing. Like what Durga was reading from the path, that the things that we do aren't important. The spirit with which we do them is. And how do we get out of it? We have, for example, that account of when I was, you've all read the path, most of you have. When I was first told to lecture, it was quite a trauma for me because Master had been coming intermittently only to San Diego. And I always knew when he would go because I was the one who had to send the ads into the papers. And then After 2 months, the word went out, I had to send it, that he would be coming. And all the people down there were told that they had to look in the papers to see when he'd come. Saturday, however, Reverend Bernard came and said that Master can't go after all and wants you to go in his place. And I thought, oh, those poor people. This at least helped me to help keep me from being too self-involved, because I was thinking of them and what a trauma they would face. The church in those days had the curtains closed. So the curtains were closed and everybody thought Master was behind them. And the place was absolutely packed. The aisles were filled, people standing in the back, others craning their heads to look in the windows. And the curtains opened and there was this 22-year-old person they'd never heard of before. It was something for them. It was something for me, too. And also, even worse to me as far as nervousness went, was the fact that he wanted me to give a Kriya initiation afterwards. I'd been there 8 months, and I was just like this about it. But at any rate, nervousness was something that I used to have to deal with, naturally. What is the way that many people overcome nervousness? One way is to be like that dancer, just more and more affirmative, more and more just sort of overcoming the problem. And I didn't feel that I could do that. It seemed like it would go from bad to worse if I even tried. And so my other and alternative way was to think, why am I nervous? I'm nervous because I'm afraid that people will think me a fool, and because I'll look foolish. Well, in that case, I have two solutions. One is to convince them that I'm not, and that's a lot harder. There may surely will be at least somebody in the audience who won't be convinced anyway. And over a period of time, there are probably going to be a lot of people who think I'm foolish. So how much energy do I have to put out in order to not look like a fool and not be taken for a fool? In order to be able to finally relax and say, finally, nobody thinks I'm a fool. And what gain would there be in that anyway? Because they don't know me as well as I know myself. And so what would I be doing? Just putting on a colossal con job? I know how foolish I can be. And so the answer to it that I found, and I think it worked very well, was to say, well, maybe I am a fool. And if so, then what does it matter if they find out? And so I found that I could just completely relax. If they all thought me a fool, well, fine, so did I. So it made it very simple. There was just something, at least, that we could agree on. And so I found that I was able completely to relax about the whole thing, and I never used to get nervous. And I found that that's a very wonderful trick for not getting involved. We think that we overcome by getting more involved. Very often what you do is you overcome by getting disentangled. The person who wants to be important will find that he can never reach the point where he's important to everybody, and the more he is important to people, the more people want to tear him down. And the more important he is to himself, the more everybody wants to tear him down. And of course, that's what everybody wants in trying to be important, is to finally convince himself that he's important. And so what's the answer to that? You can't get out of it by being a Napoleon or whatever. They all fall in the end. Nobody can continue to push a wave higher and higher and higher. It reaches a peak and it comes down, and this is just the way of Maya. So what's the answer? To say I'm not important. To say that I don't really matter. To say that I'm a channel for the divine and he's doing it all. And there's much more freedom in that thought than there is in the thought that finally I'm there in a position where everybody's looking up to me and I'm free of this fear of being unimportant and so on. The truth is that the higher the wave, the greater the crash. And the only way out of that constant confusion of Maya, is to step back from it, not to get more into it, not to go more and more toward that frenetic dance until the only thing finally is a swoon, but to pull back and say, well, let it go on, let it go on. I'm not that. And this is a consciousness which, in the subject of service as a very good example, is very foreign to modern thinking. Women are all uptight about the idea of having to serve men, and they're sick of it. They've done it for centuries. They don't want to do it anymore. And so you see all the fashion magazines with women looking like female panthers. And they're very unattractive and very... it's very offensive to see anybody like that, male or female, but even more so female. And then the men get all sort of feeling inferior for a while until finally they get their backs to the wall and they say, wait a minute, and then they come back with both fists flying. And you just have a war. Who lives by the sword, dies by the sword. Who lives by power, dies by power. The divine law, as Master says in one of his talks that we have recorded, the divine law is such that you can never win by power. The way to win is meekness. And I don't mean meekness in the sense of making yourself a doormat. I mean realizing that you aren't important, but God's power can do anything. Many people don't understand the meaning of humility. They think that it's self-abasement. I had an interesting conversation once with one of the monks, one of the older monks. I said, you know, I've been working on humility, and my problem that I suddenly face today is that I don't really think I have anything to be humble about. And he understood me. I didn't mean that I was so good that therefore what's there to be humble about? I meant that I wasn't good enough to be humble. That what's there to be humble? What has a tramp got to be humble about? He is a tramp. He's already down there. You don't feel humble by saying I'm a tramp. But if the king of a country can be humble, then that's something to be humble about because he can give that to God. And I was saying, well, I don't have anything to be humble about. But the truth is that what we have to do is simply give everything, our failure, our success, our virtues, our flaws, all of these to God. It isn't as if we had to reach the point where on the one hand we abase ourselves and say, I'm no good. On the other hand, convince ourselves that we're good, so then we have something worthwhile to give to Him. In fact, we have to bring ourselves to the point where we see that we, of ourselves, really can't do anything at all, but that God can do anything He wants to if we allow Him and to use us, but not in a passive way. What we have to do is take the inspiration He gives us and the power He gives us and then use it. But always remember that it's His power, not our own. So an attitude of service is not an attitude of self-abasement. It's an attitude of offering yourself up to a much greater flow than your own self. To serve people is to be disappointed. To serve God is to be always fulfilled. If you serve people, they so often don't understand you. They so often take your motives for quite other than they really are. They so often don't respond in a way that is gratifying to you. They so often will use you and say, well, if you're willing to do this much for me, why not 10 times more? And they take advantage of you. So many things come in that show that there's some imbalance in your attitude because it springs from you. You can't let people treat you like a doormat. You have to stand up for yourself. You have to sometimes put on a show of aggression, but it mustn't be something that touches your heart. In your heart, you must always feel humble and surrendered to God. So what we're talking about when we speak of service is serving God in others and in Himself. Serving God is the most essential attitude because what it does is instead of building up your ego to a bigger and bigger wave, and the waves that clash together in violence in the storm are the tall waves. The small waves never have any trouble. They're always able to work harmoniously together, to flow harmoniously together. They just sort of lap and chuckle happily together. It's when the storm happens and the waves get tall that you have the crashing waves and the breaking of ships and so on. So the more you push your ego up, the more you get into the violence and suffering that comes with excessive involvement in maya, in delusion. But the more you can just let that go and just become humble and feel that you're serving God in everything that you do, just give it to God, let it be His, the more you'll find that you that you have joy. The joy of relinquishing the ego is a million times greater than the joy of affirming the ego. Everybody wants to be thought good at something. Everybody would like to think that when he's done a job, that it's been a good job. Everybody is pleased with that, and there's a certain justification for that pleasure if you give that to God too, by saying that he is the doer, and so it's his inspiration that you're attuning yourself to. It's normal and right for someone to, if you compliment somebody on something that he did, and he says, oh no, that's not so, what has he done? He's insulting your taste. In return for a compliment, he's insulting you. That's not right. It's far more gracious instead of to say in fact, I remember there was one scolding master gave me was, there was a sort of a fawning, sycophantic kind of member at the church in Hollywood. And he was always sort of laying it on with a trowel without meaning it at all. And so I had mentioned, I think, that I was going to be giving the service on Wednesday. And so he said, well, then I'll be sure to be there. Well, he would have been sure to be there anyway, and I didn't want to accept that at all from him because I knew he wasn't being sincere. And so, being only 23 years old, perhaps is my excuse, I don't know. But I didn't answer it very graciously. I said, would you then please stand at the door and check people's pockets for rotten eggs? And Master afterwards, nobody, of course, he wouldn't have said this to anybody, and I didn't say it to anybody, but Master knew everything that I and everyone else of us was thinking, even. And so I served lunch for Master and one of his guests that a few days later, a week later. And Master kept me afterwards and was talking about certain things that I don't remember exactly. But then he said, don't talk about rotten eggs like that. He said, that's not gracious. And then he said, also, 2 weeks ago, you said something to a doctor at some function. And I said, oh, I did, didn't I? But he was really on top of it, always. He, no matter what I thought, if it wasn't the right thing and the time was right to say so, he would tell me. And the thing was that you, it's not a sign of humility to be ungracious. Accept somebody's compliment, say thank you. But then either say it or feel it, give it to God. Say that God is the doer. Feel that His is the power animating you. When you serve in that kind of way, what you're opening yourself up to is that flow. And if you the joy that you feel in thinking, I did a good job, is only there in the first place because a good job was done. Any thought, I, is actually a cause of suffering. You will notice that if you allow flattery to go to your head and start thinking, I'm good, the joy diminishes, it doesn't increase. For a while you keep affirming it, we're the best, like the big parades and excitement at Oakland after the Oakland, what is it, what's their name, the football team? The Raiders? Yeah, the Raiders, right. After they won and they were all running around the streets shouting, we're number one and so on. This was what, last year, 2 years, I don't know. Anyway, I dropped out of the 20th century before I was born, I think. And so, anyway, this idea of we're number one and shouting, you can affirm it for a while, and pretty soon you begin to notice, I don't feel so good. There's something wrong, and you don't know what it is, so you try to convince yourself all the more. But you'll find that egotists can't be happy. They may be happy for other reasons, but in their egotism, their egotism is a cause of pain because it's a cause of limitation. You suddenly find you're closed in bars and walls of your own making, And so that isn't the source of your happiness. In fact, when you feel that you've done a good job, the real source of happiness lies in the fact that a good job was done. If you can understand then and give it to God and say, He's the one who did it, it's yours. That's a million times greater than the satisfaction of thinking, oh, I did well, He did well, we did well, we did something together, and you share it with Him. This is all fine. There's freedom in that. But there isn't freedom in the other. There's bondage. Service is the path of freedom. It's not the path of slavery. Somebody who's always happy to do things for other people, not because he's doing it for their approval, that's slavery. We get a mental image of somebody who's afraid to speak up for himself, who's always courting other people's approval, and we get wrong images because we've seen those too, and we know ourselves to be capable of them, and so we condemn the idea. But when you see service done with an inward thought of, I'm doing this for God, this is what I've seen very often in India, that the people there, wives, for example, serving their husbands, they do it in an inward spirit. It's not this man, it's God. And this is my role. This is my dharma. You will find that in that simple thought, there is such freedom, such joy. I've gone through the whole rainbow on this one. Because when I was in college, I was a real rebel. I wouldn't take anything from anybody. I had to think it through for myself. I had to know for myself. I hadn't the slightest thought that I'd ever be a disciple of anybody. God, what foolishness. Because I never saw anybody worth being a disciple of. And I remember the art appreciation class that I attended in my last year before I finally quit. The scene was regularly repeated whenever I did go to class, which wasn't very often. But I would come 20 minutes late. The professor would come to the door and usher me to my seat. Everybody would stand meanwhile, and he would bow, and I would bow, and then I'd sit back, and the class would continue. And I was an absolute nonconformist and rebel, and I thought, well, I don't want to follow anybody. The thought of serving people was, to me, ridiculous. I was there to serve truth, okay. But I remember even when there was a girl I fell in love with in Mexico City, and we got engaged for a while. It's the only time I ever got engaged. And I told her, quite frankly, that I'll be happy to marry you because I do love you, but only if you understand that I'm seeking truth, and that I will be perfectly happy to starve and let you starve if necessary in the process. But I am not in any way going to allow anything to stop me from what I have to do in my life, because I don't feel that I'm interested in life unless I can find out what it's all about. And this didn't cause for a long engagement. But it wasn't that I was being antagonistic, it's that I just didn't feel that I was here to be serving the world. And people would get very upset with me because I wouldn't serve their ideals, I wouldn't serve their socially accepted things. And I know my dad wanted to buy me a tuxedo when I was 16, and I said, I'll never use it, so don't bother. I said to him, I'm never going to earn enough money to pay income tax, I don't want to fill out all those forms, for one thing. But I just knew that I wanted to live as I had to live. And the thought of service was ridiculous to me because I didn't understand it. Then I met Master, and I began to have that whole, all that value system completely turned around. And I began to sing, I remember, O God Beautiful, to the serviceful thou art service. And I'd sing that for an hour or two, just that line. And feel such joy, and oh, I don't have to protect my integrity. I don't have to protect my ideals. I don't have to protect myself. It's just God. And so I relaxed in Him, and I found such joy in that thought that I kept thinking of other things that I could do to sort of give up this sense of self. It's a wonderful liberation, just the opposite of what most people think. The joy comes not so much in the service as in the constant thought of, I'm giving myself up, I don't matter, I'm unimportant, I just want to be a little tiny bubble in your vast ocean. And you are my reality, not me, not this little body. Service is joy, to the extent that it's a giving up of self, a giving up of ego, not a trying to make this world better and so on. That kind of service of the mission consciousness is very secondary to what I'm talking about. Better than serving yourself to serve others, surely. But the most important thing of all is just your service being a constant releasing of yourself. This is joy. Anything that you can do that will debase your ego in order to strengthen your soul, the awareness of God within you, is joy.